Hey, welcome to an early episode of The Humanist with one of our friends, Ben Cake.
About like, well, is that me? Or, you know, who am I to say that that's not me?
Ben is a friend of the show, and he bravely jumped in even when we were in our initial beginnings with defining what this podcast is. And at first it was going to be called Authentic Life. In fact, we were exploring on several long conversations.
And I'm actually living it. I'm not just espousing a theory.
What is authenticity before we change the name to The Humanist? But Ben is a friend of the show. He has been an editor and a writer at large for many years. He's worked with Penguin Books, Esquire, you name it, Inc., Fast Company, Glamour, Cosmopolitan. He's also explored being a copy editor for years. And this is, we explore, part of our conversation is exploring creativity. How do you know who you are? What does it mean to live an authentic life? Thanks for tuning in to one of the early episodes of The Humanist. So I guess, first of all, do you agree with the, not so much that we're all creators, were you, but more of, do you think that you always have to engage in a type of a struggle in order to really stay engaged with life and to be kind of creating, in a sense, your life?
Yeah. I agree, but I don't like the term struggle because I don't think it's helpful to tell people that you're just going to struggle forever. You know, that we're not going to make a lot of friends with that kind of terminology. What?
Okay.
Kind of a riff off of that, though, is that Stutz, Phil Stutz, who you kind of mentioned, is the author of the book. There's a Netflix documentary about him.
Yeah.
Where Jonah Hill is an actor who's a client, mm-hmm. and he makes this documentary, and they kind of go back and forth, trading therapy speak with each other, and it's fascinating. But there's a section that that actually inspired me to get out of advertising and marketing altogether. And what they're talking about is a phenomenon that he dubbed the snapshot.
Okay,
where so much of your suffering and pain in life is because you've created some snapshot version of how it's supposed to be. Where it is that kind of ideal state that once I get to this, everything's going to be. And
yeah.
And basically, it was kind of highlighted as a major point of suffering for people, and how his therapy practice is about kind of learning to tear up that snapshot. And
okay.
What I realized is that advertising's sole purpose is to create that snapshot for people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I think that we've become so habituated to creating these images and speaking in images and selling those ideas to people.
Oh, yes.
That it's a bigger issue about how we communicate with each other. And so I think there's a lot of room to explore these snapshots that we're creating for each other and to kind of... How can we get away from that? How can we get away from... Because so much of our economy is built on selling the ideas. You were kind of talking about how money becomes the sense of salvation for people. And in advertising, the easiest job in the world is to create a billboard for the Powerball lottery, right? All you need is a giant S number and a dollar sign in front of it. And anybody driving down that highway, because of our cultural associations with money... You don't need to sell anything. You don't need a sentence. It just becomes they think about mm-hmm. the things they would buy, the way they would quit their job, the people that they would tell to F off, whatever it might be, all you need is that number. And that's why, you know, even though there are stats that say more than 30% of people file for bankruptcy 3 to 5 years after winning the lottery, there's all kinds of real reality. That's not the snapshot they're trying to sell. And so I think that if there is kind of a theme to this, it becomes what you know, let's explore what are the best snapshots that we can create for ourselves, or how can we acknowledge when we are creating those snapshots and use that understanding to kind of better understand our self-conversation and where authenticity comes from that. Because again, the professor, the tenured professor, was a snapshot. You know, writing a best-selling novel is a snapshot. It's still you. Same thing with the backsplash in the kitchen. It's just you with a certain kitchen. It's just you with a book. You haven't fundamentally changed.
Yeah.
And so, what are these these snapshots can serve to motivate us?
Well, that I like where you're going with that, because ultimately I feel like we sound like we're quite indecisive or like this. And part of what I want to explore is the beginning point is like, if we're gonna like lead others, we have to be able to lead ourselves. And how does one lead oneself unless one is pretty convicted that, you know, about what we're pursuing?
Can I stop you with that, though?
Okay.
That idea.
The very idea.
The very idea of I need to be a proof of concept for what I believe in order to teach others.
Okay.
You're laying down a whole set of prerequisites for yourself that I have. What does the proof of concept constitute? I need to have a certain number of followers, or I need to have this, or what, you know, and all of a sudden you create these things that you're constantly in the battle where I do think that maybe there's merit in what you were saying earlier is nobody knows anything and kind of trying to acknowledge that and speak into that in a way that actually the proof of concept is flawed in and of itself.
So which part? The idea of leading yourself first, or this desire in the first place to want to lead others?
I get not the desire to lead. I think that, you know, there is a form of leadership in a very Taoist sense of like you, the leader is the one who follows, you know, that kind of dualistic definition of it. But yeah, I mean, we were talking earlier about Rick Rubin, and he says, I have no understanding really of music or the technical aspects of recording. I just know what I like and can help bring that out in others, you know. What was his proof of concept? You know, like he didn't say, oh, well, I need to make a best-selling album in order to do what I'm doing.
He was just doing what he really enjoyed.
And there's no way to plan that out. If you kind of reverse engineer how he got to where he was, it was, first of all, you know, it happened in the 80s and 90s. And so it was a different musical landscape. Nobody could go back and reverse engineer Rick Rubin's career and do it today.
I love that you're saying that. I've been listening to his podcast, and he was talking with a friend of his, Owen Wilson, they're friends. And he was also talking to Edward Norton, and both of them pursued with Rick. They were like, so wait a minute. So you were just doing this music thing in college already a little bit, right? And he's like, yep. And so he never got to, and it just started taking off, and he never got to this point where he was faced with, man, I might have to go to law school or something. It was just generating, and they both just said, that is so lucky. You're so lucky to not, you know, and he's like, yeah, I was. So I don't, you know, there is the idea of luck. There are a few that we see in these, like that seem to have gotten lucky. So I don't know.
Well, and that idea that, well, it kind of raises the idea, does something have to take off for it to have be deemed right?
Oh, man, I know, right? I tell you what, I like that so much, because I admire so much in the creatives who said, I am going, this is what I'm doing. And I know the world thinks I'm crazy. I don't have much money. I am poor, and I'm doing what I have to do. I have to do. I would hear that a lot as a writer. You know you're supposed to be a poet. You know you're supposed to be a writer because you have to do it. Mm. And I would challenge that. I would bristle at it. I'd be like, well, I don't have to do it. I mean, you know what? Yeah, I do have to do it because I really am. I really admire it, but then I think I'm usually hearing it through the lens of, and now they've made it. And they can look back on this struggle and that intensity and what it brought forth in them, but we're not really hearing about so much. I guess I have some examples of some writer friends who just kept publishing little chapbook after, you know, little small press novel. And that was their life.
Yeah.
And that's been their life. And it's interesting to be open and vulnerable right here and just admitting that I don't know that I see that as like, I guess I see a virtue in it, but I also see a sadness. I feel like, oh, the disappointment, because there is this belief that sometimes I have this belief of like, even if the big publishers didn't take my books, I would just write 19 of them and then they would see, you know, like what they were. And then someone would finally take the 20th book and then they would want all of them. Or, you know, I have that, but really it doesn't always turn out that way.
Yeah, there's this phenomenon of the writer's writer, or, you know, the comedian who is every comedian's favorite, or the musician who other musicians think like, why isn't this person more famous?
Okay,
and I think that speaks to a bigger phenomenon going on about expertise and how the deeper you go into something, the smaller or more esoteric the niche becomes who get it, because you're operating on a level that only people with a trained ear maybe can fully accept. And so you see that with some of the smaller journals, you know, oh, so-and-so was in the Crying Monkey Review, and it's, what?
You know? Wow, congratulations.
And
wondering what Big Self School is all about? Well, check us out at BigSelfSchool.com and see what we can do for you with workshops or trainings.
If you asked 100 people on the street tomorrow, have you ever heard of that? They'd be like, no.
No, yeah. Like 100 people will read it and they all want to just be in the Crazy Monkey Review, of course.
Exactly. Yes. And so it becomes... The concept of mastery is having a moment right now. The number of books about
mastery,
or deliberate practice, and you know, and they're kind of, it kind of spawns from Kay Anders Erickson's studies of expertise, and then Malcolm Gladwell wrote 10,000 Hours,
and Robert Greene, I think in 2012, published Mastery.
Yeah, and I think that with that is this idea that. Cal Newport had the book So Good That They Can't Ignore You. That idea that there's a safety in being the best at something. But all that time that you get studying to be the best of something could actually alienate you from the broader audience that would give you the success that you're saying without that is kind of sad. And I think that that's paradoxical, because you're reading these books about deliberate practice. You're studying how violinists became, you know, great, or whatever, chess masters or something like that, and you're trying to apply it. But it could actually be undermining the more you learn about your expertise for the sake of safety or respect or whatever. You're actually, no, it's going broad. It's writing the pop song or something like that. And so in our culture, there is the value is placed on audience and appealing to the broadest number of people, as opposed to maybe necessarily reaching that level where the people with the trained ear say, that guy's a virtuoso.
Or maybe not, right? Like what about the, you know, how, I guess what I say is sad is like, you know, you just kept writing poem after poem, book after book, and no one's really reading it, but you sold out completely. You're poor, and no one's really reading your stuff that you say is really good, but no one's appreciating. And I think there are a lot of examples of a lot of art where people are saying, that's where I think is sad. And so I think that what it's revealing is that I do have, there must be a validating mechanism to sort of justify, I guess, one's continued efforts, even though it's revealing with it. I say that I have this, there's this noble virtue to just sticking with it and grinding. And we can use a lot of examples like heavy metal bands, right? I mean, what about you're a 45-year-old and you've spent 20 years grinding it with small clubs. Do you just keep doubling down on that? Mm-hmm. I guess it just depends, right? I mean, people could just not have a family and just take care of themselves.
Yeah. In Department of Speculation, the book, the author talks about being an art monster, and that idea of like, it's ride or die. I'm going to do this. I'm not going to have a family, you know?
Yeah.
And just kind of fully committing and saying that's my life. And then she ends up, you know, having a child, and kind of the book is largely about balancing a marriage and a child with that previous ambition. It's a fascinating book. And I think that it's one that resonates with what we're talking about and with a lot of people about, trying to live a full life, but then, maybe what resentments pop up, or that what could have been that comes up, what could have been. And I think that probably happens with these people. You're kind of creating this archetype of the person who's written, oh, this 15th book is going to be the one.
And
it becomes, well, if I don't, you know, will I regret not having written that 15th book? And you see plenty of stories that begin like, yeah, I'm an overnight success who's been doing it for 20 years.
Sure.
You hear that a lot. And so I do think that there is something to be said and admired about that kind of commitment, and to do things with detachment from the outcome. I certainly think that, and, you know, as we're talking about it, you kind of said, oh, well, and a poor, or, you know, and so those become kind of external judgments that people can feel shame about. And I think that to some degree, there are people for whom that's irrelevant.
Irrelevant?
Yeah, irrelevant. I'm sorry. So I'm not a member of a golf club. I don't play golf anyway, you know? And so those sacrifices don't feel like sacrifices, or they don't feel like that. It's not sad to them.
Yeah. I'm just thinking that, yeah, right. It's not sad to them. Okay. Yes. Okay. In my youthful energy, I thought that I could just kind of do it all, have it all. Mm-hmm. So I think that sometimes we think maybe the things that we think would, and I remember feeling sometimes maybe a little judged by people above or ahead of me, like in their 60s or 70s, who had sacrificed the family but were amazing poets, mm-hmm. or writers. And they're like, oh, okay, Chad's settling down in the suburbs and he's married and he's now about to have his second child. And okay. Good, you know, I guess you've sold out. Yeah. And mm-hmm. and I'd be like, I would just think to myself, feeling the judgment of like, oh, you just wait and see, you know, like I'm going to have it all.
I'm going to come over the top here any minute now. Yeah.
but here I am with a lot of unfinished projects.
Yeah. Well, I think that we have to, we absolutely have to talk about judgment of ourselves, from other people, every direction of judgment, and how that affects authenticity. Because, you know, judgment can go in a lot of directions. You can judge up. You can judge people who are very successful and point out things that you think are flaws. Like, for instance, you
were and we love to do that.
And, you know, you were talking about kind of the sadness of people who are writing that 15th book. I feel that every time I see a commercial in which a celebrated actor or actress looks into the camera and says, "What's in your wallet?" And it becomes you have this huge career.
She's a pitch person now.
Yeah. And it becomes kind of like, is there a sadness there that you peaked at, you know, 28 and the projects aren't the same? Or, you know, some people who are in great shows and now they do mostly voiceover work for cartoons. It becomes kind of like, what are the feelings around that? And to some extent, you also see it with musicians where they put out a lot of great albums and then they're judges on talent shows or something like that. And it becomes kind of, I'm not saying that to criticize them. What I'm saying that is that their life has changed. Maybe they have kids and it's hard to produce good work. You don't know if that next album is going to be filled with bangers or not. And so it becomes kind of this thing of like, it's much easier to collect a steady paycheck, show up and judge other people's work and be in hope at home in time for dinner.
Yeah.
And the first half of their career was building this audience and this credibility, and the dividend that's paid off is now I do this. And maybe there is absolutely no shame about that, or maybe, you know, there are some days of, I really need to get back into it. I hungered to do what I did. I don't know, but I think that there is a compassionate way to kind of explore that judgment. And then there is just a way to write people off or to criticize out of jealousy. Or I think that judgment and jealousy have a lot to do with each other. And to some degree, you can kind of, it becomes a mirror to yourself. If you're judging out of jealousy or criticizing out of jealousy, it's because you feel maybe, or you know, I know the times that I judge people in that way. It's often because I'm trying to justify why I haven't gotten someplace.
Sure.
Or I haven't done that because, and then I come up with kind of this.
I raised a family.
Or this consolation prize of like, hey, you know, this is what I chose to do. And so I think that those self-narratives and kind of exploring them is probably where you get to a greater understanding of what you're really talking about and how you fit. And that gets complicated by when somebody else just slams you with some criticism like, you know, but you never did this, or, you know, and something along those lines. And then you feel, I think that you feel kind of displaced from all the stories that you've told yourself because you've been laid bare by this criticism that feels like it landed in a way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That there's truth. It stings and we defend ourselves against it. That's the topic. We could go, let's shift directions a little bit.
Sure.
If we could. So I'm curious, cause you know, you're still a writer. Your identity is as a writer and you've done a lot of writing, right? Journalism, books, and would you say you're a copywriter? Are you, is that vocationally what you do now? Or you said you decided to stop doing that.
Yeah, I'm in the process of trying to stop doing that because it is, it's not why I became a writer.
Mm-hmm.
If I had wanted to create these snapshots or be a salesman, I would have graduated school and become a salesman.
So,
you know, I think that for logistical reasons and just the way life goes, it was something I tried. And you know, you kind of use the term taking off. I got invitations to do it. And you know, that ate up 7 years of my life, you know, in a way where there was some takeoff. But at a certain point, I was at an altitude where it felt high enough to crash, but not high enough to really go, but not high enough to go anywhere in a way that was going to be satisfying. And so, yeah, I'm actively trying to figure out what comes next because I can't picture another 40 years of doing that. And that's kind of what I'm looking at. Could I relive tomorrow every day for the rest of my life and be satisfied? And when I say no more than I say yes, then it's time to make a change. And that's uncomfortable and it's scary, but it feels like if I'm not going to do that, I can't expect others to try to be authentic, or I can't, you know, I kind of have to live that. That's becomes my own kind of proof of concept of that I'm willing to struggle with that. And that, so when I give advice to people or when I try to engage with people, I know that that's where I'm coming from. And I'm actually living it. I'm not just espousing a theory.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Humanist with Ben Cake, our friend. And thank you to Umphreys McGee for this wonderful music from their 2022 album, Small Strides. You should check them out, see their tour dates and what they have going on. And thank you, Dale Woodfin. Shout out for the intro music and other music that we also have on the podcast. We'll see you on the next episode. Good.